Hi, I'm Sharon. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sharon.
And my cheering section came from Bellevue over here. No, Debbie and Bob drove up, and that was such a nice surprise. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I have made some great friendships. And it's what Judy was talking about. It's kind of an understanding of the heart. It's kind of, you are my family of understanding. I have a family of blood, and they still don't understand me. They love me, and they're glad I'm sober, but they want to know why I still have to go to so many meetings. And they don't understand a lot of what I do, but they respect it. But you understand me. I can come here and tell you that I don't wear polyester when I fly because it sticks to you when you burn. So I wear cotton clothing when I fly, and I'm getting real good at it. Today when I got off the plane, Judy called me last night just to verify, I guess, that I was on the flight, and we just kind of thought we'd know each other, and it's funny out of that. It was a very crowded terminal, and I just looked for the one with the big gulp in her hand, alcoholic-sized soft drink. And Paula was with her, and Paula said she was amazed that Judy and I, we just kind of locked eyes out of that crowded terminal and said, "Are you Sharon? Yeah, I'm Sharon. Are you Judy? I'm Judy." You know, it was like this little secret exchange, and Paula was just shaking her head like, "How did they do it?" You know, and I told her, you look for the big gulp. You look for the alcoholic-sized drink. And it's amazing because there's a connection that I have with sober alcoholics, and there's a connection I have in my heart goes out to alcoholics who are still drinking and using, because I don't ever want to forget what I felt like when I was out there. Because for 14 years and 11 months and 14 days, I haven't found it necessary to do any research. And it's a day at a time, as it is for all of us. And tonight I get to be with you, and we get to celebrate sobriety. And I want to thank you for having me here. It's I think I've made some good friendships. Judy and I found the old hippie shop, and we just went right in there. Like, that smell of incense just pulled us in. And as before we got there, we're walking down the streets of Lawrence, Kansas, and I looked at Paul. I said, "I feel like I'm having an acid flashback." They had just had a parade, and there were clowns and Shriners, and it was very bizarre. The whole town was out, and I knew I was sober, but I wasn't quite sure for a moment what zone I was in. And life amazes me, and the beauty of it is I want to live today. When I wake up in the morning, and I feel and I know where I am in my own bed, which is a joy every morning. And I come to, and, you know, I'm grateful that there's a day ahead of me. It used to be oh, my God, another day. I mean, I lived a day at a time before I got here, but not in the positive sense. It was just surviving through another day. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we've been given a chance to enjoy life. You know, it says in the book, we absolutely insist on having fun. We absolutely insist upon it. And if you're sober and you're not having fun, start having it somehow. You know, you got to work the steps, but there's a lot of fun to be had. You know, it's a serious program. People die from this disease, but there's a lot of laughter here. And thank God, because the laughter is healing. And I grew up in Iowa, and that was my first resentment, so I'm going there tomorrow, and I've made peace with all of that. When I drank in the bars and I wasn't in the state, I would be at least from Wisconsin because they had cheese, you know. Iowa had pigs and corn, and it just wasn't sophisticated enough for me. But now I tell people where I was born with kind of a smirk on my face, and that's okay because I have made peace with my past in almost every area. And I am a dysfunctional adult of a normal functional family. I don't know about you, but I'm it, you know. Nobody in my family drank excessively. Nobody got in trouble excessively, and I did. I took to it like a fish to water. When I was 14 years old, it was the summer I turned 14. I was 13 turning 14. I didn't have my permit yet. And I was sitting on a 57 Chevy, and I was out in the middle of the country roads, and we were all out there, and the Canadian Club in one hand and the Schlitz beer in the other, and it was natural, you know, for me to take a hit on the Canadian Club and to wash it with the Schlitz beer. And as I was sitting there, I noticed my legs got a little curvier, you know, and the chess fairy visited me briefly. And I stood up a little straighter, and I could dance with the boys, and I could talk to the football players, and I guess I drove them all home because I was in better shape than the rest of them. I don't remember it. I hadn't really had my permit yet. But the next morning, I had the hangover and the remorse and the guilt, and we were going to church, and I remember feeling awful, but I also remembered what that magic moment was. I remember that feeling when it hit my toes. I remember that relief I got. Just the mind shut up, and I just stopped judging myself and being so serious and worrying about everything, and it was like the party started. And I remembered alcohol did that for me. And I didn't go out and get drunk every day from that point on, but I got drunk at every point I could. And I watered down my dad's booze, and I stole it, and I knew how to get drunk, and I knew how to follow the boys around and steal theirs, and I knew how to hang out with the older ones, and I just knew how to do it instinctively. And I got through high school with not a lot of trouble. I did get in some trouble, but I was an overachiever, and I had really good grades, so I looked good. You know, I looked good, so they would kind of excuse my behavior, and the police that would drive me home occasionally, and that kind of thing. But nobody really worried about me too much. And when I went off to college, it was like the full bloom happened. I had a fake ID. I could drink in the bars. I spent more time in Joe's Place than I did in education classes. I pledged a sorority, and I tried to do it like I thought I wanted to do. You know, I wanted to be a teacher. I had some goals. I had some dreams. I wanted to get married and have a family. I wanted some things. And alcohol took a lot of those hopes and dreams away from me as the time wore on. And I gave it up freely. I gave up freely. By the time, it was 1968, and I had gone off to the Democratic National Convention in Chicago with my sorority sisters to campaign for Eugene McCarthy, and we were all dressed in our Bobby Brooks matching sweater and skirts and little matching patent leather shoes, and we had the campaign hats on. We probably had white gloves and a purse, you know. I mean, that's the way we looked. And by the time that convention was over, you know, the patent leather shoes were off, the bare feet were on, the bell bottoms were on. I was marching behind Dick Gregory to Mayor Daley's house, you know, to tell him we were mad at the way the cops were treating us. And, you know, with the bottle of Matus in one hand, the joint in the other, the peace sign in one, and the finger in the other. And I just did a flip. I mean, I just did a total flip. My eyes got open to a whole new life. And when I went back to college, I moved out of the sorority. I moved into an apartment. And things got real crazy. I had my first suicide attempt that year. No big deal. I just woke up in the morning and started slicing my wrists. Stone cold sober. My father came down with a family priest to find out what was going on and to try to talk to me because they were beginning to wonder about me. And the priest and I got real drunk that night, I remember. My dad sent me to a psychiatrist, but my sister sent me to a psychiatrist. My mother sent me. A lot of people sent me to psychiatrists, but they weren't successful with me. If you don't tell them anything, they can't help you. And I would go in there and fold my arms and kick out my feet and think, we're paying you $75 an hour, buddy. Figure it out. You know? And I started to have an attitude. And I also have selective hearing, you know. People tried to help me along the way. A lot of people tried to help me, tried to give me advice, tried to tell me they love me and then maybe if I try this it would work. But what I heard them say, which was, you know, an old tape of mine, was, you're not enough. You're not enough. And that's what I heard them say for a long time. Well into Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't enough. And based upon that feeling about myself, I did a lot of crazy things. I got heavily into psychedelics because I was on the search truth. And you could find it on 16 four-way hits of Orange Sunshine. There's truth there for a moment. You know, it happens. But I loved to drink. I knew when I cracked the top of Jose Cuervo Gold, I knew that it would take me somewhere. You know, I had no control over that. And I liked that. I loved alcohol. I loved the way it tasted. I loved everything about it. I ended up being kind of asked to leave school. My father asked me to leave home. My dad and I had a huge fight, and irreparable. And I ended up going to New York City and getting a job in an advertising agency and drinking a lot. You could drink in that town. I was old enough to drink. And they drank two-hour lunches, or you had a hangover, and you'd close your door, and you'd get well, and you'd go drink your lunch away again. And it was a good place for me to be. It really was. But I got stranger and stranger. I remember I had a standing appointment every Friday afternoon in the West End Bar with the phrenologist, who's the guy that reads the bumps on your head. And so I would have that standing appointment with this guy, and he would read the new bumps on my head and tell me about where my life was going. I mean, this is who I was listening to. And I was heavily into tarot cards and I Ching and things like that. And I would put on my long black coat and my black hat because I was taking a lot of diet pills and things like that, too, because I like to just go and walk Central Park late at night. And I would bring home the musicians in the park. And we would stay up all night long. And then I'd pop some more uppers to get going and go off to work and drink a two-hour lunch away again. And here we go. And I did that over and over and over again. And I did it so badly, I started to get so paranoid, I couldn't go down in the subway. I would hyperventilate. I would have anxiety attacks. And I'd spend all my money on taxi cabs. And I had all these locks on my door because I knew somebody was going to mug me, and I got mugged as I was trying to get the right keys and the right locks one night. It's just too many locks. I was out there forever, you know. The keys jangling, and you know, all I had to do was hear the keys jangling, and they'd be up six flights of steps, you know. But I was getting stranger, and I called my father and begged him to let me go back to college. I begged him for one more chance, and I got it. And I got back in school, and it didn't last long. My disease was pretty full-blown then. I ended up going to Colorado because I thought I wanted to be a cowboy, and I had an opportunity, so I ended up near Aspen, Colorado, and things were going real good for me. I hadn't made a bad reputation for myself yet in that town. I had only passed out a couple of times on the sawdust, on the shuffle board in the Mountain Man Bar, and I hadn't done too much damage yet, and I was working at this little restaurant, and somebody walked in, and he looked like Bob Dylan, and he ordered a chocolate milkshake to go. Well, I made two chocolate milkshakes to go, and I came to California with this guy, and I don't know who he was, really, but he was very spiritual, I can tell you that, and we ended up in Huntington Beach at a commune. He went his way. I stayed at the commune. I stayed 4 months. I came with $2. I left 4 months later with $4 and a dog, and I made a profit, and I had a great time, and I thought, this is the way I want to live. You know? This is the way I want to live. And I ended up back in Colorado, and something had started to happen to me, though. I had turned 21 out here and out in California. It was the night that I had panhandled for my wine, because it was appropriate, I thought. So I got some wine, and the Krishnas were dancing across the street, as they do in Westwood. I don't think they do it anymore, but there was a Bank of America building, and they made that their hub, and that's where they would dance for their new recruits, I guess. And I'll tell you, I don't know, those people always spotted me. I had this brown aura or something, this hole in my psyche, you know, and they would just always, the Pentecostal Holy Rollers almost dunked me. I mean, you know, the Laguna Beach Jesus freaks almost dunked me. I mean, people would find me, and it always sounded good because I was lost. I was in search of something. Believe me, I was. But as soon as they said, this is forever, I ran the other way. And that's what the Krishnas did to me that night. They had me there. We were dancing and having a good time. I even got to play the cymbals. And it was my 21st birthday, and they thought it was real karmic. And then they said it was going to be forever, and I said, I'll see ya. You know, I didn't do forever. There was no way I ever did forever. And I ended up back in Colorado, and my gallbladder was bad, and nobody knew that. I ended up living with my mother and father. I was very, very sick, very sick. I would bloat up. I would get very ill. They told me I could stay there as long as I didn't take any drugs. They thought that was my problem. But I could drink, and it was okay to drink, and that's what I did. And the doctor was giving me Valium for my nerves because I was living at home with my father, which was a tense situation. My dad and I could not even cross in the hallway. We would have to stay totally out of one another's way. And but I was sick. I was very ill. Nobody knew to look for this. I guess I had pancreatitis and a non-functioning gallbladder at 21 years old. And nobody knew the signs of alcoholism. Nobody knew alcoholism. I ended up meeting another answer, and he took me to an organic farm in northern Wisconsin. And so that's where I got well. They took out the gallbladder. We started with Adele Davis and, you know, eating right to be fit and all that. And I think she died of cancer. But We read Yule Gibbons. We had honeybees. We had 50 head of organic sheep. We tapped maple trees in the winter. We made our own, boiled down our own maple syrup. We had a wood stove. We heated with wood. We worked hard. We ground our own wheat. We made our own bread. Everything was organic. And Phil took away my non-organic cigarettes, and he took away my non-organic alcohol, and he replaced it with organic marijuana. That's what he gave me. And he thought that was going to fix me. Except every once in a while, you know, everybody would look a little funny to me. And he had seen me in those bars with my cowboy boots on and passing out on the pool table and my truck driver mouth. And he thought I was much better this way. And so he was trying to help me out. And this guy really cared for me. And when he got me up there, I just saw it was an awful lot of work. You know, this life was just a lot of work. And it was the second snowfall of the winter. And I remember it very clearly because he was over there with his banjo in the corner learning to play it again one more night. And we didn't have TV or anything, so we had to entertain each other. And he had this Pete Seeger record, How to Play the Banjo with Pete Seeger. And Pete Seeger's kind of got this voice that goes up and down, and he sings songs. And he was at the part where you go bum titty with his five string, you know, and he tells you how to do it. And Phil kept getting stuck on the bum titties part. And so the cat was starting to look a little irritated, and the dog was starting to froth at the mouth, and the snow was beginning to look heavier, and I noticed I was rocking a little more intensely in this rocking chair, and I thought, you know, if I just had a drink, everything would be okay. And I went into town before the snow got too heavy, and I got 2 cheap gallons of wine. I came home, and I pulled the wine out and put it on the table, and Phil took one look at the wine, one look at me, and he went off to bed. And after 2 glasses, the cat was happier, the dog was smiling, I was having a good time, and at about, I don't know, 1 or 2 or 3 in the morning when he woke up and gave me that look, because I was sitting there totally sloshed, you know, and he gave me that look of, what is wrong with you? Why can't you just smoke these? You know, why do you have to act like that? You know, when he gave me that look, my head said loud and clear so that I heard it, and I can remember it just as if I was there yesterday. It said, you know what? Alcohol is more fun than you, Phil. And I made a decision. Alcohol won. It really did. Because I gave this lifestyle up. I got rid of them that next early summer. It took me a while, but I got blackballed by the organic community for being a drunk. Nobody wanted me around, and I went into the bars and drank and tended the half acre of marijuana I was growing, and that's what I did that summer. And I went to harvest it, and I did. I harvested this whole half acre by myself on horseback, and it took me 3 days, and I was very high and very loaded and very drunk. When I went to turn my dope deal 45 miles into a big town of Menominee, which was a college town, I had prearranged this. I was going to sell it all and get out of town because winter was coming to northern Wisconsin, and I was going to leave. And when we got there, you know, they looked at me, and I looked at them, and they said, well, where's the stuff? And, you know, I looked at my dog, and my dog looked at me. We left it back on the farm. We forgot it. We left, you know. I ended up joining the carnival that night. It was my way out of town, and that's what I did. So when they say your best thinking may have gotten you here, I kind of related to that because I went from an organic farmer to a shooting gallery girl with the carnival, and I walked the walk and talked the talk, and the cowboy boots came out of the closet, and the truck driver mouth came on just like I had, you know, left it for a moment, and I started to get pretty rowdy again, and so rowdy, in fact, that I brought the heat down in Bogalusa, Louisiana, where they woke me up with shotguns one morning and searched the room and got me for sale of drugs and threw me in maximum security down there. And that was a lot of fun. We were talking about grits tonight. There's no way I'll ever touch a grit again as long as I live. And I remember going to the dentist as I was in this condition in leg shackles and handcuffs. And I thought, you know, how did a nice person like me end up like this? I couldn't figure it out. There was no way that, I mean, I was totally perplexed as these things that were beginning to happen to me. My father flew down and tried to help out. And I remember the sadness on my father's face and the disappointment. And I couldn't even look at him. And it was, you know, I was beginning to wonder if there was really something wrong with me, that this wasn't a lot of fun anymore, this footloose and fancy-free writing my book type of life. And I found New Orleans when they cut me loose, and they cut me loose with my new boyfriend who happened to be there that night, so he got busted with me, and that's where you find him, girls, is with the carnival. A lot of potential there. And Kirby and I had a relationship for 2 years that was total love-hate. Black eyes and knife fights and just... he had a heroin habit, so after he'd give me a black eye, I'd wait for him to pass out and give him one. And very equal. But I danced for a while down there on Bourbon Street, and I wore a wig, I wore funny clothes, I wore platform shoes. I used to have to dance on a baby grand in between numbers, you know, we have to go up and dance on this piano, and I would fall off on the customers all the time because I was too drunk. And they asked me to leave after I asked for a raise, and I became a bartender, and I did that well, and I was really drinking a lot of Jose Cuervo Gold now. That was my true love. And that got me downtown fast. That got me there fast. And I hung out with the quarter rats, we called us. And I remember the bar called the Bastille. You could spend your 2 days off in this bar. Because you had, you know, when you came to my bar, I would take care of you, and you would have a tab at my bar. So when I went to your bar, I'd have a tab at your bar, and you'd take care of me. You'd put my purse underneath. I could pass out and come to and pass out. And come to, and that was the way I was beginning to drink. I lived in filth, just filth. My parents came to visit me. I was living above a biker bar, Lower St. Peter Street. We were on the end. It was a tar paper roof. We had, living next to us, Angela, who worked evenings, let's just say. Then there was the guy who drove his bike up the stairs into his apartment on the first one, and... When my parents came to visit, they found me living in that condition with a new black eye with this guy who called me four-letter words in front of my mother. We had a pet snake and a pet skunk and a dog. And I didn't know about doing laundry or anything. I mean, it was filth. And they left that day. And I know when they left, they wanted me to come with them, and I wanted to go with them, too. And it was the last time I saw them until I got sober. And... But I knew nothing would change. I knew if I went home with them, absolutely nothing would change because I was just a bad person. I had just decided that's what was wrong with me. And until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I heard that we're not bad people trying to get good, we are sick people trying to get well, did I get some relief in that? I was 9 months sober when I heard that, and it made a big difference in my life because I felt bad for so long, like something was really, really wrong with me. And I continued to drink, and I continued to run, and I ended up in St. Louis because this guy left me, and I should have been happy he was gone, but I thought, well, it wasn't my idea, and nobody's going to leave me, so about a week later, I followed him up there, and it took me a couple months to find him, you know, but I found him, and he got off his Harley, and he walked around to my car, which was a piece of junk, as I usually were, my alcoholic cars. And he crashed through the window with his helmet, and he pulled me out by my hair, and he spit in my face and said, if I ever see you again, I will kill you. And I said, okay, the relationship's over. I think I'll go home. And that's the way I let go. That's the way it gets through to me. I am very stubborn and very one-lined until I became teachable in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my world opened up. But I had a wonderful sponsor named Ginny, and Ginny told me that I'm like that girl with the gift in her hand, and you know that I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous hanging on to this precious gift. And one day, many days down the road, I trusted her enough to let her have a peek and see what this gift was I was holding so tightly and cherishing in my hand. And she looked in my hand, and she said, but Sharon, you've got a turd in your hand. And I looked at her with all the pride I could muster, and I said, I know, but it's my turd. Yeah. My turd. And it took me a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous to learn to let go of it, you know, let go and have some faith. I squeeze it until it's dead, you know. I'm loyal to a fault. You know, that can be an asset or a defect. I've learned how to let a lot of my defects turn around into the asset category. The 12 and 12 talks about that. And, but I came back to New Orleans and my drinking got, I ended up in places I didn't want to be. I would have 2 and 3 day blackouts. I ended up in Florida. I ended up in strange situations. There would be times that I would be sitting on a bar stool and I'd be, you know, a quart and a half in there and I'd be stone cold sober in the head. I couldn't walk off the bar stool to go to the bathroom, but I'd be just sober in the head. I was beginning to, look like an alcoholic woman. I caught a glimmer of myself in a corner window one day walking back, and it was daylight enough that I caught a look at what I had become, because I just stopped combing my hair and looking in mirrors and taking baths. And I thought, who is that derelict-looking woman? Who is that filthy woman? And it was me. And I bloated up to over 170 pounds, and I didn't, I wasn't somebody you wanted to take home to your mother. You know, I just wasn't that kind of person anymore. And I didn't care about myself, and I didn't care what you did to me. And it got worse. I walked over the body of my friend who had been shot and killed on Mardi Gras Day in front of me. Could have been me. I was 2 feet inside the door in a blackout. Couldn't be me. I was just seconds and inches away. And a speaker named Norm Elpe, when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, used to talk about seconds and inches that we get to sit in here tonight. It's just by that day that you wanted to turn right with all your might, but you turned left for some reason. It's just seconds and inches that you get to sit in here tonight and judge the coffee and judge the people and judge the speaker, you know? It really is. You know, it's just seconds and inches. You know, if you think about it, not everybody who needs to be here tonight is here. Not everybody gets the gift of sobriety. It's a very, very precious thing. And I'm really grateful that I've been given that gift, because that's a lot bigger than me. I ended up in Southern California. I didn't want to be here. I came back to New Orleans. I had sleeping DTs. I had I couldn't talk until I had enough to drink. Things were beginning to happen to me. I became unemployable. Nobody wanted me back, even at my old bar. My old bar was Lower Decatur Street, where I danced with the guys off the boat, the guys that smelled like the oil, the ones that worked beneath. The guys that didn't speak any English, and they would come in and they would buy me a drink and buy themselves a drink, put a quarter in the jukebox, hand me a dollar, and I was supposed to dance with them for that $1 dance. They could do what they wanted with me on the dance floor. And I got fired for having a bad attitude. And I begged for that job back. I went there and begged that man to hire me back, and he wouldn't. I had become unemployable. Nobody wanted me to work for them anymore. I ended up in Southern California again on my way to Hawaii. And I never got there. What happened was I ended up in a bar called Barney's Beanery, which was my connection to Alcoholics Anonymous, was through that bar. It's a very sick West Hollywood bar, and it's full of a lot of people who need the program, because we all drank alike in there. It's the first time I ever saw the Big Book was under a girl's arm in that bar when she was too drunk to drive to an A&A meeting, so they called her a taxi cab, and she waddled out with her friend and her Big Book under her arm, and we cheered her out the door with our doubles. And that was the first time I ever saw a Big Book was under her arm, and that was the girl that got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. Her name was Chris. And I was sitting in that bar one night, and it was July 27th, 1975, and a couple of guys out in the front in their Harleys asked me to come out and go to Palm Springs with them, and I was really excited because nobody had asked me to go with them anywhere anymore. And I found out later the reason they asked me was because it was windy driving through the desert and they needed some weight in the back tire, so they called the fat one out. And that's how I got to go. That's why I was asked places. But, you know, when I answered those 20 questions, I said no to lower companions. There was no way. I have my pride. It was one of the three I said no to. We got to Palm Springs and they left me because they didn't really need the weight anymore. And I met two new lower companions, and they took me somewhere that night, and I don't remember much about it because I had been drinking for days. You know, you can't say drunk all the time, but I had to have alcohol in me all the time. It wasn't a priority to eat. It was a priority to drink, and that's what I was doing, and I was pretty out there. And they took me somewhere, and they started to kick me around and knock me around, and they broke my jaw in three places, and they broke my nose, and they raped me, and they had a lot of fun, and I don't really remember much about that night other than I remember it at some point stopping screaming because I thought, who cares anyway? And they took me outside of town and rolled me off a cliff and left me there with no clothes on, face down. And it was a little over 15 years ago I was lying in the hospital. But I got up. There was something inside of me that something magic happened, something that's not me. A voice that wasn't mine said, get up, I want to live. Not my voice, boy. I didn't have that kind of courage or energy or will. And I did. I heard this voice, and I got up after they drove away, and I guess I walked down this road, and I found someone's condominium, and I passed out in a lawn chair about 2 feet away from a pool where a gardener found me. And that's seconds and inches, too. Two more feet, you'd have another speaker. They took me in. The police came. Everywhere I looked, I was their victim, you know, and that's what I wanted to be, boy. That's what I was practicing to be, because I was real good at that self-pity, and I was real good at being the victim. It was your fault that I was like this. It was your fault that I had ended up like this. And going into surgery that morning, I heard that voice happened again, you know, that loud voice that wasn't my voice. It said, you know, Sharon, this isn't your fault. You know, or this isn't their fault. This is not your father's fault. This is not the guy who broke your heart when you were 18 years old. This is not this guy's didn't do this to you. You did this to you. And I didn't want to hear that because I don't know how to take responsibility. I don't even know what I'm taking responsibility for, but I heard that voice. And I laid in the hospital for 2 weeks, and another interesting thing happened to me is that nobody sent me an airline ticket and nobody bailed me out. It was the first time I was left alone. And I got out and I stayed with a guy I had met at Barney's Beanery. He said I could come live with him. He lived above a liquor store and he knew I had nowhere to go. Because I had to go back to court. They caught these guys. I had to go back to the doctors. I had to be around and I was tired. I was really tired. I had not a lot of will to live at all left. And I was sitting above this liquor store sucking on red wine through the wires in the teeth where the tooth had been. And it was like drinking Kool-Aid. There was no more magic in alcohol. It began to repulse me drinking it. But I didn't know what else to do. And August 20th, he told me I had to leave. And I called my mother in Iowa. My mother always came through something for me, you know, monetarily or emotionally or something. And my mother had known something terrible had happened to me because she got a panic phone call from somebody who didn't tell her what hospital I was in. And it took her 2 days, my sister and her, 2 days to find me and to find out I was okay. And so for 2 days, she didn't know if I was dying somewhere or what was wrong with me. And she had let me go. Because when I called my mother and I told her I needed some help, she said, Sharon, I can't help you anymore. Why don't you go to the Salvation Army? And if my mother would have sent $20 that night, you would have another speaker tonight, seconds and inches. The next call I made was to Chris because her number was there. That's all. And I called Chris and I asked for help. And Chris recognized alcoholism. She was the first person because she had been to Alcoholics Anonymous a number of times, in and out. She wasn't sober at the time and she told me to call this woman Suzanne, that Suzanne could help me. So I was desperate. I called Suzanne. I didn't know who this Suzanne was. She was 5 years sober in the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Los Angeles. All I knew was that Suzanne read my mail. She said, don't drink anything, don't smoke anything, and I'll send two women over to get you right now. And I sat on the steps of that liquor store and I waited. And they came and they got me and they jumped out of this Volkswagen and they had big bright eyes and big bright smiles and I didn't like them immediately, you know? Didn't like them immediately. They put me in the back of this Volkswagen and they drove me off to a meeting of Echo Park where this Pacific group met on Wednesday nights at that time. And I had this little newspaper clipping in my pocket in case they asked me what happened to me. You know, I had no idea where I was going or what I was in for or what was going to happen. I had absolutely no idea. I have a loving God and I was led to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous where I belong that day. I was given a chance that day. And for some reason, I turned left when everything inside of me wanted to turn right, and I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I passed the 20 questions, as I told you, at 17, and made this man that looked like my grandfather very happy. I remember them beating on this book, and I kept waiting for them to come down the aisles with this water to sprinkle on me and then make me do this stuff forever, you know? Kept waiting for this paper to sign, this IQ test to take, this what have you done with your life quiz, you know? I kept waiting for the other shoe to drop, and nobody did that to me. They just said, oh, keep coming back. We're glad you're here, you know. And nobody said you look terrible. Nobody said go sit in the kitchen until you clean up, you know. Nobody did any of that. I mean, I looked bad when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were happy to have me. They put me in the front. They touched me to raise my hand, you know. They raised my hand for me. They gave me phone numbers. I didn't get it. I thought, what do they want from me? You know, I didn't get it at all. And when I left that night, they said, okay, don't drink and use between tonight and tomorrow night's meeting, and we'll pick you up. And that was all they told me to do, was not to drink and use, and they picked me up. And that was how simple it was for me. That's all I did. I had absolutely nowhere else to go. So I thought I would go come back with these people. They seemed to like me for some reason. I didn't know why. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for 2 weeks like that until I realized I was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't get it where I was coming. I was that rummy. I remember an old-timer overheard me saying, somebody said, do you want to ride to tomorrow night's meeting, Sharon? And I had a wired up. First 3 months I was here, I was wired shut. I couldn't really talk, so my ears had to open. Yeah, it was a blessing in disguise. I learned to listen. I shut my mouth up. It was shut for me. But what happened was, this old-timer overheard me saying, but it's a day at a time. I didn't know I could make plans for tomorrow night's ride. I mean, I was so confused. And he said, oh, come here, look at this. And he showed me his calendar, and it had, like, dates written, you know, a month, 2 months, 3 months from now. And he asked me, how are you right now, kid? He used to call me kid. How are you right now, kid? And he was patient because I had that Rolodex brain, you know. Some of the newcomers have that Rolodex brain where it spins. You know, you got to wait. See what they're going to say. Yeah. And we're also creative because it always lands on the card that says fine, you know. Fine. He said, well, that's what we're talking about, kid. If you're okay right now, that's what we mean about a day at a time. All you got to handle is today. But you can make plans for tomorrow night's meeting for a ride. Oh, I mean, that's where I was at. And they were real kind to me. And they moved me out of this liquor store and they gave me a sleeping bag. And they shoved this big book in my arms and I gave them my last quarter because I didn't know what they wanted, you know. So I gave them my last quarter and I paid them off. Boy, a quarter every other week until I paid off that big book. I made sure I paid it off. Because I didn't want to owe them anything, you know. I'm a real scorekeeper. You do something nice for me, I got to do it back to you, you know. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, give it up. Give up trying to keep score, you know. You just got to pass it along to the next one. That's what they told me. When they would give me handfuls of change because I had no money, and they would say, oh, call your sponsor, kid. If you don't have a sponsor, get a sponsor, kid. You know, and I would say, but I can't pay you back. And they said, that's okay. Someday when you have it, give it to somebody else. That's the way you can pay it back. And that made sense to me. I liked that. That made good sense to me, and I've tried to do that. I tried to pass it along. That way I get to stay here. I didn't know the benefit of that. But I was on different floors for a week at a time, and I would get rejected after a week. I didn't know that I was being assigned. I was like, the old-timers were trying not to get too involved. They were hoping I was going to make it, but they were hoping they didn't have to get too involved. That's what they told me later, and they were sending their newcomers over to learn to work with newcomers with me. Because, I mean, I'm sure I wasn't a lot of fun to be around, and I smelled bad, and Mary Ann says that she remembers the night I washed my hair. She nudged her friend Pat, and she said, look, maybe Sharon will make it. She washed her hair. Right, that's how slow I was when I came to you. And you didn't care about that. You cared that I stayed sober in between meetings. That's what you cared about. And you cared that I sat here and had a chance at something called life. And I got a sponsor because a guy with a Texas accent and a tattooed tear kept sticking his finger in my chest. And I didn't like Texas accents because Texans made me nervous. I barely got through that state once. And I got a sponsor so I could tell Michael to back off, you know. That's why I got my first sponsor. And I'll tell you what happened was, she moved me out of this floor I was sleeping on and moved me up to her couch. And that was a step up, I'll tell you. So as I related, get a sponsor, your life gets better. I related that. It worked, you know. I mean, it was real simple for me. A couch meant something better than where I was at. And I learned motives don't have to count. If I waited for good motives about everything in life, I wouldn't get out of bed. You know? I have learned how to act my way into good living, not think my way into it. And a lot of times today I have good motives about things. I want to do it. And then I judge that motive, but that's okay. The point is that I know how to act today. I know how to become a responsible citizen, how to be a responsible mother, how to be a responsible sponsor, how to be a responsible employee. I have learned that. My first jobs in Alcoholics Anonymous were waitressing. And I used to have a rotten attitude, and they showed me how to make an Al-Anon smile and get better tips, you know. And they showed me that toothy grin, you know, that big toothy grin. And they said, they don't care how you feel, Sharon. They want their food hot, you know. And give them a funny smile, and your tips will get better, and they did. I thought you had to tell the world how you felt all the time, and I brought everybody down. Nobody wanted to even sit in my station anymore, you know. I learned how to fake it till you feel it. I do that all the time out in the world today. I don't understand that world out there. There's no way I get it a lot of the time. But, you know, I'm a good employee today. I used to call my sponsor, and she was mean. She was mean. She was half Mexican, half Indian, and she was littler than me, so I thought she'd kind of be easy to overshadow a little bit, intimidate a little bit, but no way. She had this funny laugh, too. She's like, quack, 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 quack. And I'd be in a meeting, and I'd be mad that she wasn't going to be there, and then I hear this laugh in the back of the room, quack, 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 and she was there, and I felt better. I would feel better when I hear this funny, silly laugh, you know, and it embarrassed me, but I felt better. And She also wore these funny clothes. Nothing ever matched, but I could always find her in a crowd. She was real little, but I could always spot her because she was bright. She was always bright. And Janet, one morning I called her and I said I couldn't go to work. I had the brain tumor, you know. I didn't feel like it. I'm tired of working. I'm tired of doing this stuff. I'm tired, tired, tired. And she said, that's okay. You just, if you don't go to work, you die at home. We won't give you a funeral. But if you go to work and you die there, we'll give you an AA funeral with lots of flowers and lots of fun. And she hung up the phone, you know. Well, she pissed me off is what she did. I got up. I thought, I'll show her. I'll show her. I went off to work, and I did everything the way I was supposed to do it, the way she told me to do it, just to make her mad. You know, I thought I could call her at 5 o'clock and tell her I still had a crappy day and I did it her way, you know. But I'll tell you, every time I do it somebody else's way, a sponsor's way, I never have to call them up at 5 o'clock and tell them I had a crappy day because I forget about myself. You know, I get into the course of living the day and everything's fine. Between me and my sponsor's air, between me and me is those 12 to 14 people that live up there that change clothes in the middle of the night. You know, I don't know who's wearing white and who's wearing black anymore. And if I listen to them, I'm in big trouble. You know, and I need a sponsor that's louder than my own head. And I've always had one that's been louder than my own head. Thank God. You know, thank God. I got emotionally involved because they said not to. I don't know. He had 27 and a half tattoos, and he appealed to me. He had 6 months of sobriety. He had done his fourth and fifth step because I read it. When I did mine, he didn't read mine. I was getting a little smart by then. But We went off to do service work and date together. That's what we did. He did coffee, I did cookies. He did general service, I did central office. I mean, we just did everything together. And we were joined at the hip a lot. And that sponsor caught me one night outside the meeting. She said, you better get your own higher power or you're going to get drunk. And she made me mad again. There she goes, sticking her finger, a little finger up in my face again. That little girl. And so Beacon's truck moved by that and just drove by that night. And it was a Thursday night meeting, and I was standing outside with a bunch of newcomers, and I said, okay, Janet, look, Beacon's will be my higher power. And I thought, well, I'd make her mad. And she just said, good, as long as it's not you. You know, she just didn't care. So I prayed to Beacon's for a long time. And in fact, I saw two of them this week, and it was always when I was uptight and in a situation and worried about this or worried about that, and a Beacon's truck would drive by, and I just go, oh, it's going to be okay. And it still works for me. So if you don't have a higher power, get something, as long as it's not you, and start there. You know, it's evolved from there with me by working the 12 steps. I wanted to get drunk when I was 11 months sober. Oh, no, I wanted to have my slip. I heard everybody talk about their slip, and I started having tunnel hearing, and everybody about their slip and how glad they were they had their slip, and they learned this on their slip. And I thought, well, I'm 11 months sober. If I get a year in, I'm committed for life, so I better hurry up and go have my slip. So I got a credit card in the mail. God's will, you know. I ended up at the airport, and I thought, well, I'll call her to tell her goodbye, and I'm off to have my slip, and I'll be back. And she was mad because I hadn't called her in a couple days anyway. And so I told her what I was going to do, and she said, fine, Sharon, go ahead. Don't finish your inventory. Don't go do that. That might keep you sober. Go have your slip. My friend Stella did that. She wouldn't finish her inventory either, and she burned up in a bed. And I dropped the phone, you know. It's like they go to sponsor school for these stories, you know. It's under the word slip, the story about burning up in the bed, you know. They look it up, and they read it to you. And, well, she made me mad again. So I was sat there at the coffee shop, and I bought me a book, and I bought me a pen, and I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote. I let anger work for me today. I wish I was angry more often, then my house would be cleaner. But I wrote that inventory that night, and I go to the airport to write every inventory still. I don't know if it's the people coming and going, all the strangers, the jet fuel. I don't know what it is, but I like to go there to write my inventories, and so it works for me. But I took my fifth step, and it was an experience that was great. I mean, she shared back with me tackier, seedier things. And I took my first birthday cake, and I felt like I deserved it because I had done something that was very hard for me. It was very hard for me to put down on paper all those nickel and dime crappy little things and share it with somebody. And I felt like I deserved my birthday cake. It was the first time I felt good about myself in a long time. And when I sat in the Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, every time they read Chapter 5 and they would get to Steps 4 and Steps 5, I could smirk back at the people that had given me the thin little blue lip looks before, you know, because they had done theirs already. And I felt more committed here and more like I earned my seat here. And I had no defects of character, of course, not until you get married. My dad and my mother and my sisters came out for an Alcoholics Anonymous wedding. We got married after I was 2 years sober. We had a Baptist minister marry two ex-Catholics. We had a day at a time put in the vows. We had a rock and roll band. We had Mac the Knife was our wedding song because it was the only kind of slow song they could play. And my father looked at me at the end of that day and he said, Sharon, you've got it made here. Look around you and look at your friends. If you think about doing what you were doing before, why don't you think twice? And my father was giving me some approval for the first time in a long time. I had done my written amends with him. And it was nice because I already had my own approval. I already approved a little bit of me and my life. I was beginning to get some self-worth. Beginning to work for it. By working the 12 steps, I have begun to feel better about myself. It takes work for me. I have to appreciate it. I have to work for it. If you hand it to me, I do appreciate it, but not like if I do it for myself and work hard for it. And going through the 12 steps the first time was work for me. It was very, very hard. And my dad, after I was about 5 years sober, we were still a little tense. And my sponsor by this time was a woman named Ginny, and she asked me if I had paid him back the money I owed him. I thought, well, how does she know I owe him money? Is that under 5 years sober time to pay back father in the sponsor book or what, you know? And she said, well, why don't you call him up and ask him how much it is? Well, my dad had been to Alcoholics Anonymous before with me. He came to a meeting and he got the big book. And I swear when I called him, he had a figure that was just sitting there in the book under amends, you know. If Sharon calls, give her this number. Because he gave me a figure like that. And I called her back and I said, I think it's too much. And she said, I don't care. Call him back in a couple of days and what can you afford? And we talked about it. And tell him you're going to send him so much a month. And so in a couple of days, I thought, good, I'll call him back, and he'll have lowered the figure or thought about it or remembered that I didn't finish college like the rest of the children, that I never went to Europe like the rest of the children, that he never bought me a car like the rest. I just took those things. And I called him back in 2 days, and he said, fine. So I called her back, and she said, okay, what did he say? And she said, he said, fine. She said, make out your envelopes, and don't be late, and send it on the first of every month. And by the way, with that check, I want you to put a note about your life and what you're doing. And that's like, here they go. They want everything from me, you know? Make me grow. Make me get well. I mean, so I did that. And for over 3 years, I sent my father a check and a note about my life on time, not willingly. I remember 1 month I called her and I said, I think it's too much. And she said, he's putting it into a trust fund for you. Send it. And I sent it off early that month, you know? All my dad got was the end result of taking an action of Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't know my motives involved. He just got the end result of an action of Alcoholics Anonymous. And on the holiday season, after doing this for 3 years, he called me. It was after Christmas. And he said, Merry Christmas, Sharon. You don't have to send me any more of your checks, but don't stop sending me your notes. And my father and I started a new relationship that day. It was amazing. It was like somebody just cut loose of about 20 pounds off each shoulder. He's my dad today, and I'm his little girl, and he's my friend, and I'm his friend, and we can spend a whole day together without getting on each other's nerves, and it's nice to be able to serve my parents. It's nice to be able to be sober so that when the phone rings in the middle of the night, they're not worried that they found me somewhere or something else is going on. You know, it's nice that my parents can sleep at night today. I am a parent today. I can't imagine what I put them through. But my relationship went on the rocks about 5-6 years of sobriety, and he decided to become a punk rocker and quit going to AA. He got another tattoo, finished the one and got another one. And I tried. He used to follow this group called the Cramps. So I spiked up my hair one night and made a My Doll shirt, and we went out to try to go to this Cramps concert, and all they did was slam each other around the floor, and I ended up having an anxiety attack peeled to the wall, and I just thought, I can't do this, and I went to Al-Anon. I was forced into Al-Anon. I learned to release him. I learned how to let him go. I learned how to go on with my life, because I would do things like put his record albums in the oven in the morning and turn on the oven and think about having to call my Al-Anon sponsor, who would then make me replace every single one of them. So then I would turn them off and put them away. And I walked into my Al-Anon meeting one night, and there he was sitting there learning to release me at my Al-Anon meeting. And the ice broke, and we began to do something together that we did well together, which was backpack up in the High Sierras. And so we went backpacking a lot that summer, and we became friends again, and we broke through again, and things became good again. And then I got pregnant, and I didn't know I could do that. I didn't know I wanted to do that. And on June 23rd, 1984, Wesley was born, and he was born with all his fingers and all his toes. And I was grateful again for the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's six now, and quite the kid. The marriage didn't last. We were together another year and a couple of months, and in January of 86, he left. And I couldn't tell that newcomer on the phone I was talking to feel good about herself and look herself in the eye and say, I like you, and believe in a higher power who loves her, and to have faith and lay down and be a doormat as he walked out the door. I just couldn't do it. I had to let him go. And it was real painful for me, because I had become what I wanted to be. I thought a mother and a housewife. I was very, very happy doing that. I was sponsoring a lot of women. I was speaking in AA. I was doing a lot of service work, and I was very comfortable. And it was like the rug was pulled out on my life. And nobody got custody of the meetings. Thank God they were big meetings, because he would circle his wagons and I would circle my wagons on opposite ends. And it got real painful for me. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous didn't let me lie in my bed and worry about life. They didn't let me vegetate. They didn't let me not go to meetings. They would come over and physically take me places with them. I was plugged in enough that people cared about me. I had given a lot to Alcoholics Anonymous, and now I was having to sit there and be given back to, and that's hard for me to take. I'm a real good giver, and I had to learn to be a taker that year. And people took good care of me. By this time, a man named Clancy had become my sponsor, because Ginny had gotten off a plane from Paris, France with 21 days instead of 21 years, and I had to go get another sponsor. And she's got 5 years of sobriety today, and she's doing fine, and I love her very much, but I had to get somebody else, and I picked this man because I had watched him in my group for all those years, having fun and keeping the light alive in his eyes of Alcoholics Anonymous. He is relentless with what he does for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to stay young here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to keep that spirit and that glow and that feeling alive. It took me 7 years standing at a podium to feel my birthday cake. I finally felt from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes a complete human being. I finally had that feeling of that I was God's kid and I was okay. It went all the way through my stomach. It didn't stop on that plate glass like it usually did. I had a feeling of completeness at 7 years of sobriety, and I wanted to keep that. And that's why I picked him to be my sponsor, because he has that zest for living Alcoholics Anonymous. And he walked me through that year like a newcomer. I remember being at the Saturday night meeting, and my ex was over at one corner of the room with his new her, and she was younger than me in sobriety and younger than me, and wasn't as cute as me, but... She played on the softball team, and so I joined the softball team that played her softball team. And she was a left-handed hitter, and I played second base. And after one AA tournament one Sunday, it was one of the innings, her team stood up and gave me a standing ovation, because not one of her balls got by me. I got hit in the face. I got hit in the leg. Not one of her balls ever got by me that whole game. I was motivated. And... But we were at that meeting one that Saturday night, and Clancy happened to be in town that night, and he was at our home group, and he saw me on one corner of the room, and they were on the other corner of the room, and I had two hot cups of black coffee just for them. I was on my way over to them with this hot coffee in my hand, and it was like the room stood still, because Clancy spotted me, saw where I was headed, came to the middle, intercepted me, took the coffee out of my hand, grabbed me by the shoulders, and looked me in the eye, and he said, Sharon, you will walk through this with dignity and grace so you can be an example for others. Well, I heard him. And I gave up the spare keys to my ex's car that I was going to drive in the ocean soon. And I quit driving 120 miles on the freeway at night so that I could get picked up and thrown in jail. I stopped shoplifting at the Broadway. I stopped doing self-destructive things I was doing in sobriety. I stopped it. I told on myself, and I started to work the steps again with him. And I was like a total newcomer again. And my life turned around on me. I was sitting in the Catholic Church on Ash Wednesday, and waiting for Sheila, who is a nun that I sponsor. I've made my amends to the Catholic Church. I sponsor a nun. And it's really a blessing. I get to tell her to have faith all the time. It really is wonderful. But I feel comfortable there now. I can walk in and walk out and feel comfortable. And that's another freedom. That's another healing that's happened here. And I was sitting there that day, and it was about a year and a month to the day that he had left my life, my ex. And I felt that completeness again happen to me. And I thought, thank God. I think I'm through the hallway now. You know, one door closes, the other one doesn't instantly open, you know. It's like I want instant results my whole life. That's why I drank tequila. It was like starting a Harley. It was downtown right now. One door closes, the other one better be open, or at least I better be able to see it. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have learned how to walk through the hallway. And if I'm not so self-obsessed, I can take the blinders off and find out there's a lot of you in the hallway with me. And I can talk about why you're in the hallway. We can put down throw pillows and hang up art and sit in the hallway and help each other through these times, because that's what it's all about. It's a process of getting to the other side constantly. And then we can talk about, guess who so-and-so got through the next door. He's out of the hallway, you know, and be excited for somebody else having that healing happen. And I became a little more patient and a little more understanding and a little more accepting. And I gave up being a victim. I hung up the black. I have new choices today. And that was like a lifelong script I sat up on the wall. I just sat it up on the shelf. And I got new choices again in life. It's a continual process of growth here. And the only way to get to the other side is to walk through it. You know, that's the only way. I mean, you can go all the way through the forest. Eventually, you're going to get there. You know, hopefully, I'll stay sober. But I like to just keep going a day at a time through it all. And not being so self-obsessed that I think I'm the only one in pain, you know. Self-obsession and self-pity will kill me. Self, self, self. That's why I come here with you, to lick my wounds and to hear your stories and to be rejuvenated and to know that Alcoholics Anonymous works. To watch the newcomer walk in the door with those dead eyes, and to watch them 2 weeks, maybe 3 months, maybe 6 months later, watch that light come on. I can't give it to them. That's a God. That's a higher power. That's a power greater than me. That lets me know that Alcoholics Anonymous is alive and well, and it gives me hope. That's why I have to come here and be rejuvenated with you, because I can still get lost out there. I went and got me a real job with a law firm. I paid my attorney so much money for a hideous divorce that I decided to go out and work for him. And that's what I did. And I've been there over 3 years. They know nothing about me except I'm a good, hard worker. And they respect my opinion, and they like me. And I make a good living there. And my son is able to go to that Catholic school where that nun is I sponsor. The Lutherans asked him to leave after about 4 months, so he didn't do too well in their kindergarten. I don't know why, but we thought we were having a major problem, but all it was changing the view for him, and he's doing fine now. And we've been through ups and downs, and he's had his times, but I didn't have to ever put that child between me and this messy divorce. And today, me and that ex-husband and my stepwife, I call her, and that new baby, we're all friends. We're all friends. We were standing in Clancy's backyard on the 4th of July, and you wore name tags there, and there was Al B and Jill B and Baby B and Wesley B and Sharon B, and we're all standing there talking and holding each other's children. And it was thought, only in Alcoholics Anonymous, only with a program can something like this happen. And we're good friends today. It's amazing. And I got to go home last year about on Labor Day, just about a year ago. I got to go to Iowa and share at a conference, and I got to make a lot of amends and go back home. And I was sitting at the table one night. My mother was cooking, and my father and my son and I were sitting there, and we were listening to the locusts and just chatting a little bit, and the fireflies were coming out, what was left of them. And a feeling of peace came over me, and a feeling of belonging to that family that I had never had in my life. And it was another healing in Alcoholics Anonymous. Unexpected, totally unexpected. There's so much to be had here. There's so much love here. You know, we don't all like each other all the time, but I wish you well, and I want you happiness, and I want you sobriety. And where do you know that you can come from 170 pounds of bloated mess, hadn't washed my hair or washed my body, come and you sit me in the front row. I have a raccoon face and wires all over my mouth. I'm missing teeth. And you put me in the front and you're proud to have me here. Where do you know that that can happen? And you see something more in me than I could ever see in myself because you understand me. And that's the beauty of it, is you are my family of understanding. You understand me, and that my whole life I felt alone until I came to you. I'm so happy to be here tonight. I want to tell you I have a guy that I love very much that's got 8 years of sobriety, and we have a good time. We have a lot of respect for one another. And nobody had to move their clothes in. And we're still at that fun dating magical stage. It's 3 years later. We move slow. But life is good for me today. I've got a beautiful son that I can't have. Send him to Grandpa and Grandma's. He's been up there for 3 weeks. I can't wait to go see him. I miss him terribly. I start my day out in the morning by hitting my knees, and I end my day by hitting my knees, because I know that I am not doing this alone, that I am loved by a power greater than me, by a loving God. A loving God that is in your eyes and in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am so happy to be with you tonight. Thank you very much for bringing me to you.